Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secret. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays only on Hulu.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump goes in front of the United Nations to say it's every nation for itself. And who wrote his speech? It's Wednesday, September 20th.
The Assembly will hear an address by His Excellency Donald Trump, President of the United States of America.
Mark Landler, set the scene for us in the room at the UN on Tuesday.
Well, this is, an annual event, but it's a different one this year because it's the first time President Trump has spoken to the UN General Assembly.
Mr. Secretary General, Mr. President, world leaders, and distinguished delegates, welcome to New York.
And in this cavernous room, he is facing many people that he is about to be sharply critical of.
It is a profound honor to stand here in my home city as a representative of the American people to address the people of the world.
So talk us through this speech. How does it start?
Well, he begins with a rather boastful opening about how well the United States has done since Election Day.
The stock market is at an all-time high, a record.
He talks about unemployment being at its lowest level in 16 years.
We have more people working in the United States today than ever before.
It's classic Donald Trump. These are lines that he has and could have delivered at any number of political rallies over the past several months.
Our military will soon be the strongest it has ever been.
They're very familiar to Americans, but they're quite unusual to an international audience that's simply not used to listening to a leader in that setting basically deliver a sort of a political pitch.
I mean, I was so struck by it, like you, because I can imagine a developing country, a small country, going before the General Assembly to brag about their economy, maybe as a matter of interest to the United Nations, but it's not something I would expect from one of the big five countries, the biggest of the big five countries.
Well, you're absolutely right. And what's even more unusual for the United States is typically the American president, when he addresses the UN, is touching on the biggest and most important global issues. So for the president to begin on this highly domestic, openly political kind of angle was really just completely unheard of for a presidential address to one of these groups.
It is entirely up to us whether we lift the world to new heights or let it fall into a valley of disrepair.
So from there, Mark, it seems for a few minutes like President Trump's going to do what you'd sort of expect from a U.S. president going before this group for the first time. He starts giving a pretty standard, galvanizing speech about the U.N. and its history and why it's important.
This institution was founded in the aftermath of two world wars to help shape this better future.
Yeah, this is very standard boilerplate.
The United States will forever be a great friend to the world, and especially to its allies.
Right after the president praises the UN, he changes his tone.
But we can no longer be taken advantage of or enter into a one-sided deal where the United States gets nothing in return.
This is the point at which the president is pivoting from talking about the possibilities for collective action and the possibilities for the United Nations to be a force for good into making what for him is the fundamental point, which is that he represents the United States. He's always going to put the interests of the United States first. This, of course, is the America First strategy he articulated. He's unveiling it to a global audience for the first time.
In foreign affairs, we are renewing this founding principle of sovereignty. Our government's first duty is to its people, to our citizens, to serve their needs, to ensure their safety, to preserve their rights, and to defend their values.
It's something everyone in the room was expecting to hear, but at the moment he began talking about it, you could almost feel how galvanizing it was to the people in the room.
As President of the United States, I will always put America first.
The phrase America first is being translated and piped into the headphones of all these diplomats in hundreds and hundreds of languages.
Right.
So you have to imagine the scene where all of these people who, again, have almost never heard a message from the United States that is this unapologetically aggressive and unapologetically self-interested, suddenly coming through their headphones. So it's a remarkable moment, certainly not one that virtually any UN General Assembly has experienced in the last few decades.
If we desire to lift up our citizens, if we aspire to the approval of history, then we must fulfill our sovereign duties to the people we faithfully represent.
And the president uses one word over and over again, the word sovereign. And I control F'd this in the speech and found he used it 19 different times. What does he mean when he says sovereign? And why is he using that word so much in the speech?
The phrase sovereignty is vital to understanding this speech because what he is saying, in effect, is that the proper way for nations to deal with one another is through the principle of sovereignty. In other words, that every leader, not just Donald Trump, but every leader in the room will put the interests of his people and his nation above all others.
The United States of America has been among the greatest forces for good in the history of the world and the greatest defenders of sovereignty, security, and prosperity for all.
I went back and looked at how many times President Obama used the word sovereignty in his first speech in 2009. The answer is he used it once, and he immediately followed it up by saying, one of the problems of the United Nations, this collection of sovereign nations, is that it sometimes becomes a talking shop for grievances and grudges.
That is fascinating. First of all, I love how intellectually synced we are that we both went and searched for that word. And I wonder how unusual a vision of the UN this is. Are there other countries or foreign leaders in that room that see the UN this way? It's tempting to imagine Vladimir Putin kind of vigorously nodding his head along this line.
I mean, it so happens that some of the most prominent nationalist leaders in the world didn't come to the UN General Assembly this year, Vladimir Putin being among those. But yes, there's no question that for several of the leaders, I dare say for a couple dozen of them, this is music to their ears. They've always thought of their country's interests in this nationalistic way.
Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
And what about smaller nations that depend on the kind of, not just the collective action, but the collective kind of financial power and generosity of the member countries of the UN?
Yeah, if you're a small country, I think the speech gave you some reason to worry.
No one has shown more contempt for other nations and for the well-being of their own people than the depraved regime in North Korea.
When it came to the particulars of President Trump's talk, there was one example in particular that felt like it really illustrated the kind of internal conflict of his message to the UN.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
I think what's interesting about this speech is it both criticized the UN, but then found a role for the UN. There was a duality to this speech.
Right.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for. Let's see how they do.
In almost the same breath, President Trump is trying to assemble this coalition of countries, of like-minded countries, to take on the North Koreans. And then in his next breath, he's saying, and by the way, if you don't act, we're going to obliterate this country. That's an extremely strong statement to make in a body like that. To hear President Trump almost dare the UN to step up and do his job, or perhaps we'd have to take this action, was a striking moment.
Mark, what would you say was the intention of the comments on North Korea?
I think the president was trying to raise the level of urgency and force the international community to act. There were a number of targets for those remarks, but I think the main one was probably China, which has the most leverage with North Korea and which has historically been reluctant to take strong action. And I think President Trump was basically putting down a marker.
It is time for all nations to work together to isolate the Kim regime until it ceases its hostile behavior.
Mark, if I'm a foreign leader, what was my takeaway from Trump's first major speech on Tuesday to the United Nations?
I think in some ways the president fulfilled the advance notices on him. He delivered something that was unapologetically and robustly nationalistic.
The Iranian government masks a corrupt dictatorship behind the false guise of a democracy.
He delivered scathing denunciations of Iran and North Korea, but also Venezuela.
The Venezuelan people are starving, and their country is collapsing. Their democratic institutions are being destroyed. This situation is completely unacceptable, and we cannot stand by and watch.
So it was a bracing message.
And in your mind, did President Trump ultimately embrace the UN, or did he challenge and kind of throttle it?
I think in some ways, oddly enough, he did both. He challenged the financing of the UN and the burden that he said it places on the United States.
The United States bears an unfair cost burden. But to be fair, if it could actually accomplish all of its stated goals, especially the goal of peace, this investment would easily be well worth it. Major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell.
In the end, he finishes talking, and what happens? Are these people applauding? Are they silent? What's the reaction in the room?
We will fight together, sacrifice together, and stand together for peace.
President Trump got polite applause as he left the dais, but there was no question that there was a big difference with the reception he got versus the reception Barack Obama got. President Trump, I think, was greeted more warily as someone to be feared rather than someone to be greeted with open arms.
Thank you. God bless you. God bless the nations of the world. And God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much.
Mark, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Michael.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by USA for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. UNHCR responds to humanitarian emergencies around the world that have caused record levels of displacement and human suffering. 90% of refugees live in countries facing food shortages and malnutrition. Your support is crucial in delivering vital aid to the world's most vulnerable families. Will you help support refugees by making a gift today? Together, we can help refugees and displaced people all around the world. Donate today at unrefugees.org/donation.
When you think about the 2024 election, how do you feel?
Sickened.
Hey, y'all. Ested Herndon here, host of The Run-Up from The New York Times. And recently, I've been asking this question a lot.
I feel tired. I feel a little scared.
And I've been hearing the same sort of answer in reply.
We have an incompetent incumbent and a Republican that I'm not going to vote for. Yeah.
When voters look ahead to the 2024 presidential election, they feel apathy, dread, that it's just a mess. The Run-Up is your guide to that mess. Each week,
I am going to vote for the man with the most impeachments and the most indictments.
We'll talk to voters, elected officials.
I believe America can do for anyone what she's done for me.
And the candidates themselves, all to help you better understand this moment in American politics. The Run-Up is new every Thursday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Maggie.
Michael.
Who wrote the speech that President Trump gave at the UN on Tuesday?
So the speech had a couple of influences in it, but the main hand writing the speech was, and as it often is, Stephen Miller, who is the president's young 30-something policy aide, former Senate spokesman for Jeff Sessions. He has risen to a huge place of power within the Trump White House, especially as one of the remaining real nationalist voices now that Steve Bannon is gone, Mike Flynn is gone. You know, you can go down this roster of people. Stephen Miller is really it within the building for right now.
Well, you just described him as I think of him, as somebody who has somehow survived what feels like a very deliberate effort to sideline the nationalists in the White House. And it seems surprising to me that he would be given the reins to write a speech of this significance on behalf of the White House, kind of introducing itself to the world.
Look, I would say a few things. Number one, he doesn't write it solo, right? So this has inputs from the president himself. It has inputs from James Mattis, H.R. McMaster, John Kelly.
So his whole national security world.
These speeches are much more traditionally written than this White House would ever like people to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And so it is this illusion that is coming from his brain and only going to Stephen Miller. That said, Stephen Miller has been working with the president for a long time. He was early on the campaign. Mm-hmm. Trump loves him, feels a personal connection to him, feels comfortable dictating his thoughts. And so in these rooms, you know, Stephen Miller will have some seed and the president will spout out something, whether it's an idea or a specific phrase, but it is usually, you know, some arc of an idea. And Miller then translates that into something that resembles a speech.
What was Stephen Miller setting out to do in writing the speech?
I mean, among other things, capture some very pure sense of Donald Trump's voice and the way that Donald Trump has gone about foreign policy so that you didn't have a speech that felt jarringly different than the way he has talked about foreign policy in the past. And remember, he has made these very, very fire and brimstone, or to be specific, fire and fury comments about North Korea. This couldn't really deviate from that because that would be sending a very specific message. So Stephen Miller's goal was to keep this in line with what the president has said before without going too far beyond the norms of diplomacy.
So as shocking as it was to hear the president actually say some of what he said about America first and destroy North Korea, as shocking as it was to hear him say that to members of the UN, you're saying that this was kind of a modified, necessary version that contained the DNA of what he has always said in the past.
Correct, or at least certainly what he has said in the recent past, and that was incredibly important. One of the things that has been confusing for world leaders dealing with this White House is the fact that this president is not consistent in what he says about foreign policy. This was pretty consistent for Donald Trump. This was a familiar Donald Trump.
Maggie, there was a line in the speech that felt like classic Stephen Miller to me. The president said that we must, quote, love our nations enough to protect their sovereignty and preserve their cultures. Does that sound like Steve Miller to you? And what is it code for?
It's a very important pickup on your part. And I think that that is one of the clearest examples of it from this speech. Culture is, you know, something of a code word that you have heard this president in particular use as a wink toward a nationalist base, often a white nationalist base. Culture is where this argument around preserving statues, these Confederate monuments, has been based. It is what the president has said in defending his response to Charlottesville. And so hearing that line, I think, had a very, very specific meaning. And yes, that is absolutely Stephen Miller.
But interestingly, in the context of saying it to the UN and all these global leaders, it could also mean the exact opposite. It could be the celebration of different cultures and wanting to protect that.
One of the genius qualities of Donald Trump's campaign, as you know very well because you watched it, was his ability to say one sentence that two different groups would hear very differently. And so I would argue that that culture sentence is very much one of those. On its own, it could either sound like he is talking about a preservation of a one specific culture, which is how it has been used in terms of this national dialogue about monuments. It could also sound as if he's talking about multiculturalism. He's just talking about cultures, especially because of the setting that he is in. And I suspect that is going to be an aspect of the speech that different sides heard differently.
Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you, Michael.
Here's what else you need to know today.
That people expect us to overcome all these challenges in as short a time as possible.
After being widely condemned for her silence, the leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, publicly addressed the plight of her country's Muslim minority, who have been massacred by her country's military and are fleeing the country by the hundreds of thousands.
It is not the intention of the Myanmar government to apportion blame or to abnegate responsibility. We condemn all human rights violations and unlawful violence.
The United Nations has called the crackdown on the Rohingya a textbook example of ethnic cleansing.
We are committed to the restoration of peace, stability, and rule of law throughout the state.
But in her speech on Tuesday, Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, did not criticize the military, which is accused of killing, raping, and burning down the villages of the Rohingya. And the second powerful earthquake to strike Mexico in the past 2 weeks hit Tuesday afternoon, toppling buildings with people still inside. Dozens have been reported killed, and the number is expected to rise much higher. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.
With Schwab Investing Themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy all the stocks in a theme as is or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.